Hey, this is Eric Slick from Solo and Dr. Dog and drumming on the Instagram. You can buy my album Wiseacre on May 28th through Org Music or at any independent retailer. And you're listening to The Vinyl Guide with Nate Goyer.
Well, hey, everyone, it's Nate here. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of The Vinyl Guide. This week, we are talking with Eric Slick, who took time out of his busy schedule of warming up his vegan nuggets to discuss his new album, Wiseacre, which is a tremendous album. I've been listening to it for weeks now. Wiseacre is available on all streaming services. You can enjoy it immediately. And although the first pressing on vinyl is now completely sold out, Eric is doing a second press of Wiseacre through Org Music. So you can order your copy of Wiseacre at orgmusic.com, or better yet, go bug your local record shop about getting Wiseacre into the store. That is a huge help because not only do you help keep the money in your local record shop and keeping them in business, but maybe they'll get a few more copies in, maybe play Wiseacre around the shop sound system, maybe get a few other people into Eric's music as well. That's a huge help. So go do that. Bother your local record shop. Get your copy of Eric Slick's Wiseacre through them if you can. Now today we're going to talk all about Eric's musical journey. Right now he's part of the band Dr. Dog, but he also spent time in the past playing with the likes of Adrian Belew. He's a complete zap ahead, so we're going to dive into that a little bit. But overall, Eric is just a very talented songwriter and musician who really knows how to just sculpt the air, you know, so when it reaches our ears, it evokes an emotion, a response, and that really is the reason we all listen, yeah? I mean, Wiseacre is already one of my favorite albums I've been turned on to this year. So we're going to talk about the history, the recording of the album, his musical journey, and we'll cover all that today and more. And by the way, if you enjoy what we do here on the Vinyl Guide podcast, please consider becoming a patron of the show at patreon.com/vinylguide. Up there, you get early access to episodes, secret episodes, extended interviews, and more. You know, there's actually a slightly longer version of this interview up on our Patreon page, and this episode also went up there last week, so Patreon folks have been enjoying this conversation for quite some time now. Plus, all of that, you could help support this show and keep it going, which I am eternally grateful for. So all you got to do is go up to patreon.com/vinylguide, and thank you so much in advance for your support. Alrighty, them's the upfronts. Let's start the Vinyl Guide interview with Mr. Eric Slick.
Hello.
Hello, Eric. How are you?
I'm well. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Got myself a nice coffee here.
That's wonderful. I'm in the middle of making some vegan chicken nuggets, so this is a good combo.
Vegan chicken nuggets. Is there any sauce on these vegan chicken nuggets, or?
There'll be a side sauce.
Are you a vegan?
Not a vegan. I'm a vegetarian, but we try to do vegan as much as we can.
You know, I did vegan for about 4 or 5 months last year, just as a bit of an experiment to see if my doctor noticed. I'm kind of the age now to where, you know, I get my blood taken about every 6-12 months or something like that. And it's always been trending kind of in the wrong direction. every time we get the results back, the doctor would look at me with a raised eyebrow. So let me just do vegan for, you know, several months, and then I'll let him take my blood test and I'll see if he notices. And sure enough, all the trends went positive, like, you know,
wow,
in the right direction. Now, I haven't stuck with it.
Sure,
but,
sure.
But it did reset the way I look at food. I've always had a weird relationship with food.
Me too.
Yeah.
I completely understand. Yeah. I mean, I was like the kind of kid who ate, you know, chicken tenders for every meal, mozzarella sticks, anything fried or meatballs, you know, that was what I ate as a child.
Was it comfort food or was it just kind of convenient? You were left there and that's what you just knew how to cook. It was the easiest.
No, I mean, it was just what I wanted all the time. My parents would take me to this place called Ribbit, which was a frog themed barbecue restaurant. It doesn't exist anymore, but it was sort of like, like a TGI Fridays kind of spot. And I think every time I went, I got chicken tenders for dinner. I was very fussy as a kid eating. And my mom always joked that my taste was really pedestrian. But then when I started touring, I was 18 years old. I had a tour manager and band leader that was raw vegan. And he gave me a pita pamphlet on the first day of tour and was like, you should consider going vegetarian. And I was so nervous that I was just like, yeah, I'll do it. I'll go vegetarian for this tour.
What was his logic? Was it more energy? Was it what was his reason for proselytizing it?
I think his reasoning for trying to convince me was just like, he ran a co-op for years and he was a health nut. He still is a health nut. He's still around. But he was just like very into exercise and health and well-being. And then he was also very much into like environmental issues. So I think it was a combination of those two things. But the first thing he showed me was a pita pamphlet, and you like open to the, you know, first page and it's like the most brutal chicken factory images you've ever seen in your life. So I was just like, that was reason enough. But I had never really been exposed to that. This is what you have to understand too. Like when I started touring, it was probably around 2005, 2006. Mm-hmm. And so like this stuff was out on the internet, but it wasn't as widely available as it is today. So for example, seeing the pamphlet was really shocking to me. Whereas like when I got older and I saw that stuff on, you know, YouTube or whatever, it was a little bit more palatable, you know?
Mm-hmm. Strange choice of words, but okay.
You know what I mean? It was a little not palatable, but it was like a little bit more like, okay, I've seen these images. They're still awful, but like,
right.
Palatable is not the right word. What am I talking about?
Are your nuggets done yet? Maybe you're just hungry.
Probably. It's late in the day. You know, we've been up for a long time. Yeah.
Unfortunately, I don't run a cooking podcast.
Seriously. Are we on like a PBS affiliate? Like, are we, is it going to be us? Are we going to be the Jacques Pepin right now?
Yes. Welcome to the Food Network, Eric.
Yeah. Thank you.
Look, I got to tell you, this new album, Wiseacre, is absolutely wonderful.
Thank you.
I've been playing it around the house the last few weeks. My wife, even my kids are kind of noticing the earworms. It's really, really delightful.
Oh, thank you. That means a lot. I try to write earworms, but you know, sometimes it just ends up being actual worms. So you might want to go to the doctor for that.
To get a dewormer pill.
Yeah.
So exactly. Is that how the songwriting process starts for you? Do you start with kind of that, I'm not the type of person you could fit, like that little bit that you cut, that nugget that you expand on? Is that typically how it works?
Yeah. And great use of nugget, great pull. You know, I think that, yes, usually it starts with some melodic hook for me. And generally speaking, it happens when I'm walking around and then I'll kind of hum it into my phone, hum it into the voice memo, and then take it back to the house, you know, hack away at a guitar, sing it for a couple minutes, and then put it away. And usually I'll walk away from it for a little bit. It's very rare for me to like sit down and fully flesh out a song. Mm-hmm. Now, there were a couple instances where that happened on this record that were really unexpected and great. But like most of the time, I'm writing little fragments of melodies and finding ways to connect them. So it's like I'm trying to find the connective tissue between part to part.
And for the maybe dozen songs on this album, do you overwrite? Did you write like 30 or 50 and then cull it down to this many? Or did you just
definitely
work lean and mean on these?
No, definitely. It was a ton of songs. And I even got so crazy about it that like I was writing all the way up until about a week before we were recording, just to see if there was anything left in my psyche, you know, anything left in my subconscious that I could turn into a song. I was trying to at least finish it. I got really inspired by a couple of different songwriters who I think have sort of like a more monastic process, mm-hmm. where they sit down and write a ton of material and then sort of cherry pick the best stuff. I think the guys in my band, Dr. Dog, also do that, where we end up making a collection of songs. But what was fun about this process was like, I wrote a ton of songs and then it was about finding the through line, like finding the best songs and then seeing which songs had a narrative arc to them. And maybe I'm old fashioned, but like, I love a full album. Like I love like a full album. It always like makes me despondent when somebody tells me like, oh, people don't listen to full albums anymore. And it's like, I get that. I get that in the streaming age, like it's harder and harder to have the attention span to sit with a full record. But I'm also of the mindset where it's like, if I'm putting something out into the world, I want it to feel as complete as possible. You know, I want it to feel like a cohesive idea, because like, what if somebody does like listening to it through that lens? I wouldn't want them to think that like, I just, you know, haphazardly made a record and then, or rather, I just threw some songs together and like the first five are the ones that are on the streaming services.
Right.
I just thought that, I thought that would be like kind of a disservice to the material that I worked really hard on, you know?
Well, if it's important to you as the artist, then that record should be reflecting you and your interests and what you feel is important. And yeah, maybe 2% of the people may really get it, but that's okay. That's, you know, that's the connection that you make.
Exactly. And like, I think the greatest joy was like a lot of my artist friends wrote to me after the album came out and they were like, man, you really like honed in on the cohesion of it. So like it was palpable to some people, and that made me really happy. Like, you're like, wow, like the font choices on the record and like the color choices, like everything was intentional. And I think I'm still very proud of that. You know, it's easy to just like, and I think I used to be like this, where I just throw a bunch of things together and hope that it worked. Whereas this time around, I made it much more of a point to like, again, write a ton of songs, pick the best songs, think of an aesthetic, you know, think of all these things think of all these ways of presenting it, because it is an important part of making a record.
You mentioned a through line of the album. What is that through line?
The through line, a boy becoming a man. No, I'm kidding. The album is about the last couple of years of my life, getting into a new relationship and then eventually getting married, but all of the sort of twists and turns and, you know, things along the way, I guess, you know, learning more about yourself and learning more about who you are in that process. That's what the album is essentially about. And, you know, the sort of ups and downs of learning to be a better person as well. So I wanted to do that all through the lens of a very joyful musical experience. And I think a lot of my material before Wiseacre was very like dark and brooding. I'm not like a very dark and brooding person, but I had this sort of complex where like, for whatever reason, every time I went to sit down to write, I was like writing when I was angsty, or I was writing like when I was in a mood, and then it would just come out like that. And so people were like, huh, you're this like bubbly person, you know, why is it that your material is so dark and brooding?
Oh, because that's the time where you would songwrite. You would take the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny, because like there are some artists who use the writing as a salve and like their material is super joyful. And then you meet them and they can be, you know, pretty miserable or something. So it really could go any potential way. But I think that like my personality wasn't gelling with the music that I was making. And I think I had created an idea of what I wanted to be as an artist in my head, instead of just being myself, mm-hmm. being the authentic self. So the whole making of Wiseacre was really enlightening in that way. And I'm glad that I took my time with it. It took about 2 years to make the record. And again, this was all just a, you know, trial and error experience, and trying to find, you know, okay, what is it about music that I like, and what do I gravitate towards? Do I gravitate towards super dark stuff? You know, sometimes, but mm-hmm. it's not what I always want to put on.
Is it cathartic for you,
making dark stuff?
Well, being able to songwrite and then look at this complete piece in reflection of where you've been, like you said, it sounds like it's semi autobiographical. So,
fully autobiographical. Yeah. I mean, every line on the record is in reference to something that happened in my life or something that happened in the last couple of years, and sort of the like radical honesty of that whole way of experiencing it, you know? So yeah, it can be cathartic. And it's interesting that you say that, because I'm going to be playing like a socially distant show soon. And I was playing through some of the songs on guitar last night, and I was like, man, I'm so excited to play these. Like, this is good. This is not only going to be cathartic because of like the post-pandemic, or, you know, I don't want to say post-pandemic, but maybe like towards the end of the pandemic, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And these songs, I've been dying to play these songs because these are actually like the exciting, upbeat songs, you know? Mm-hmm. When I toured my first record, Palisades, something that I noticed every night was that like everything was so slow and it was like, and everything was so dark. So it didn't necessarily feel great to play it on stage. You know what I mean? I'd just be like up there playing like some really ugly tritone chord on guitar. Just like, oh man,
wow, I'm really depressing these people.
Yeah. And the funny, we were on tour with this band called Sin King, which is like the most uplifting Sudanese, you know, Sudanese, like kind of like a jam band, but kind of like Talking Heads-y kind of music, very joyful, mm-hmm. all about like uplifting spirit. And we'd go on there before them and be like the dark cloud. like, all right, let's get this out of the way before like the really great band comes on, you know? So I didn't want to go through that again.
So I started seeing some tour dates pop up for Dr. Dog towards the end of the year, which is nice to see.
Yeah.
Do you see yourself touring Wiseacre at all?
I'd love to. I mean, it would be amazing if I could do a couple of shows. I don't know how realistic it is, but like, you know, I think there's also a lot of practical stuff that goes into it too. Like a lot of people had tours that were canceled. So the fall is flooded with people who put out records in 2019 who didn't get to tour on their album, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think all of those people are going to get the pick of the litter first. Mm. And then hopefully, you know, at some point in 2022, I could do some shows for Wiseacre. But by then I'll probably already, you know, have another
next one.
yeah. And then I can, you know, play some songs from Wiseacre and still it will feel really fun. I'm just looking to have fun.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about. Now, did you have a big musical family? I mean, your sister is a musician as well. I imagine the Slick family had a lot of music around the house. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Big time. And my parents will probably listen to this, so I'm going to juice them up pretty hard, but like, but yeah, no, my sister and I, grew up playing as a rhythm section together. I was playing drums since I was about 5. And then my sister started playing bass around 10 or 11. And we just became like the de facto rhythm section around town. And then we ended up getting a gig with Adrian Ballou from King Crimson, which was just totally crazy. But yes, to answer your question, my parents played music in the house all the time when we were growing up. And my dad's a guitar player. My mom is a writer. My grandfather was a jazz trombonist. My Aunt Joni is a classical harpist. Like there's a lot of musical stuff going on in the family. Mm. And we were encouraged to play together as much as we possibly could.
Okay. So music was a big draw in the house. There were always records on. What sort of music do you remember as a child kind of echoing mm-hmm. through the house?
Well, you know, this is a vinyl podcast. My parents, we listened to vinyl all throughout my youth. Like, I mean, we had CDs around the house, but my parents were a big fan of doing like Friday night vinyl night. Mm-hmm. So we'd put on like Stanley Clark records and Emerson, Lake and Palmer, King Crimson, Santana, Eric Clapton, like heavy on the classic rock. But then we'd also listen to like Mazursky and we'd listen to, what else? I mean, Ella Fitzgerald, like it was pretty diverse, but heavily rooted in the classic rock stuff and also blues rock and blues guitar music. My parents named me Eric after Eric Clapton. They were really hoping that I was going to be like a hotshot blues guitar player. There you go. You know, they were really, when I played drums, I was like, I hope I'm not disappointing you all, but I think they're okay with it.
When I interview people here on the show, they generally fall into one of two camps. One camp is I became a musician because we had a very musical family and I watched my parents, you know, react emotionally to music and I wanted to be part of that. And it meant a lot, blah, 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 blah. And then the other reason that a lot of artists get into music is because that was their ticket to get the hell out of town. They wanted to have a great time with their parents or their family or whatever it was. And that was their ticket out of there.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah. It's generally one of two camps. So you seem to be clearly in the camp of, you know, you watched your parents value that music
and you saw how important it was to them. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, they were so into music, and you know, I didn't really have much to rebel against as a kid. My parents were like, all right, well, you want a drum set? We'll figure it out. We'll get you a drum set. You know, it was like, and then they're like, you want to practice until 10 o'clock at night instead of doing your homework? All right, sure. Like, they were pretty cool about everything and liked listening to us play together and were super encouraging. So to all the parents listening, it's a good thing to encourage your kids to play, for sure.
So the drum set, that's a big ask for parents.
Yeah. I still feel bad for our neighbors growing up must have just thought I was insane, you know, listening to like the Police at full volume, playing along with Stuart Copeland. Yeah, who knows?
Yeah. Now, which records became yours? Like what records or what music did you bring into the house that wasn't part of your parents' ecosystem?
Sure. Well, Frank Zappa, for one, which is kind of surprising. You'd think that my parents, with all the music that they liked, would be Zappa fanatics, but they kind of viewed Zappa as this more like outsider figure, you know, or iconoclast. And also the music was like pretty filthy dirty. So I brought home Zappa when I was like 11. And then the 80s King Crimson stuff was something I contributed. I was definitely like not totally listening to what kids in my school were listening to. Mm-hmm. It's funny. Like when I was in second grade, they asked me what my favorite song of the year was. And I was the only kid in class who said Tears in Heaven. Mm-hmm. Whereas like everyone else in class had said Gin and Juice by Snoop Dogg. So I was definitely bringing something different to the table, I think. But then I guess in my teenage years, I had like a slight phase where I listened to MTV music, like stuff that was on Total Request Live in the late 90s, early 2000s, like Limp Bizkit and Korn. And I think my parents were like, you're going to regret this. Like, yeah. And then shortly thereafter, I think I sold all of my nu metal CDs and then got really into... Yeah, you know, more modern progressive rock and like the Flaming Lips. So I was like turning my parents on to like Elliott Smith, Flaming Lips, Beck, that kind of stuff.
Okay, so you and your parents, that you still share music back and forth with them, yeah?
Absolutely. Yeah, my mom will still send me stuff that she likes and be like, "Hey, have you heard this?" And I'm like, "Yeah, that sounds great." Or you know, we're a very musical family for sure.
Okay. And how do you go from having a rhythm section in your house with your sister to then moving to Adrian Belew's band?
We'll be back after these messages.
Well, hey there, vinyl collectors. Do you know that AudiophileUSA.com has a ton of original jazz records, 7,383 to be exact, many of them audiophile quality and ready to ship to you wherever you are. Over at AudiophileUSA.com, you'll find Blue Note, Music Matters Jazz, Analog Productions, and heaps of other titles, all in excellent and near mint shape. Some of them are even still sealed. So don't be slow. AudiophileUSA.com is a family-owned and operated vinyl record dealer, and with over 42,000 vinyl titles in stock, there's something for everyone at AudiophileUSA.com. Go to it. When you get those records, you're going to need something to clean them with, which is where the Groove Washer record cleaner comes in. The Groove Washer is the best record cleaner on the market. I use it daily, and it keeps my records clean, my listening experience wonderful, and my collection in archival shape. Other record cleaners can leave a residue on your vinyl, which over time can make your records gummy and sticking to their sleeves. Don't risk devaluing your collection. Ask for the Groove Washer by name, and look, here's 10% off anything at groovewasher.com. Use checkout code VinylGuide10. Do it now. Groovewasher.com. Checkout code VinylGuide10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. How do you go from having a rhythm section in your house with your sister to then moving to Adrian Belew's band?
I mean, it was a lot of pressure. It was like, because Adrian was somebody that I really looked up to. And like, I'm talking like I had data discs. Remember the data disc when you put like a bunch of MP3 files on a CD? Mm-hmm. Did you? Yeah. So I had like the data disc of like every King Crimson record, every Bowie record, every Talking Heads record. And on my walks to school, I would like try to figure out what Adrian was doing on guitar in my head. And then like to get, end up by chance meeting him in 2005. And then he needed a band. And he was like, do you want to be in my band? And I was like, yeah. Are you kidding? It was kind of like a dream scenario. I mean, and in a similar way, it was, that's how Dr. Dog happened too. Like I was a fan of the band. And then one day they were like, do you want to be in the band? And I was like, yeah. So I feel very lucky that those situations kind of fell into my lap. But touring with Adrian was amazing. At first it was super high pressure because you're having to play all these parts like that have become iconic, you know, like Bill Bruford's parts or Danny Carey from Tool. Adrian himself is a phenomenal drummer. So there were some pretty big shoes to fill. And then my sister, same. I mean, like Tony Levin's bass parts and John Wetton, kind of like these heavy hitters of classic rock. We were like 18, just hacking our way through it.
So that's quite a limb he walked out on, taking a couple of kids, you know, as you were back at the time, on tour.
Yeah.
I mean, how did that happen? I mean, you said a chance meeting and he asked you to join the band. It must've been some sort of audition, right?
Well, he came to my music school to do a seminar, but at that time I was no longer a student. And then the owner of the music school was like, hey, Adrian Belew's actually coming to town. He needs an assistant for the day. So I was his personal assistant for the day. I carried his amplifier around and we just hit it off. Like we were fast friends. Mm-hmm. And then at some point, like he was checking guitar and we were laughing. And then I sat down at the drum set and then we just like started playing some King Crimson songs together. And it was actually like more organic than you'd think. Nice. It wasn't just like this tense thing. It was like, he was in a really good mood and we were laughing and joking around and 1 minute later, I'm playing drums with him. And it was kind of like playing with your friend in a basement, except that your friend in the basement is like one of the best guitar players in the world. So it was crazy. And then I went down to Nashville to like properly audition. And then my sister flew down maybe a day later and she got the gig as well. And he was like, oh, this is kind of fun. Like a family band. I think for him at first it was a novelty and then we grew into a really powerful band together and toured the world for about 3.5 years.
That's interesting because, you know, the rhythm section always has to be very close and very tight and very characteristic for the band. But to be able to have a rhythm section that grew up together, that were siblings, that must add a whole different level of, I'll say, telekinesis to the rhythm section.
Oh man. And we got that a lot, you know, especially when we would improvise, my sister and I kind of always knew where the other one was mentally because we're in a band together all day too. So it's like you put that on top of growing up with somebody and knowing what their instincts are. And it's magical. I mean, like, and it's still that way with my sister. Like every time we play together, we can fall into the same kinds of patterns. Mm-hmm. In the same way that like you'd fall into a conversational pattern with a sibling. It's much like that, you know?
Okay. What did you learn from Adrian?
He taught me to, oh man, that's a loaded question. I mean, he taught me like what not to play. You know, he is really good at reining things in and, not, you know, we could all improvise together without stepping on each other's toes. And that was a huge lesson. And then also just like grooving and playing in time. Like he's such a groovy guitar player. He's known for like the kind of wild stunt guitar stuff, but like his rhythm playing is actually one of his strongest suits. So if I was playing something too fast, we'd lose the pocket. And I think he was really good at like helping me learn about that. I mean, I learned so much in that time. I learned like I completely upended my technique during that period. I learned how to tune drums. I learned what drums I like. Mm-hmm. Like when you're a kid, you're just like, you're still kind of mimicking a lot of people. Mm. And I think when I joined that band, he was helping shape me as a drummer and being like, you know, you should listen to Jim Keltner, the way Mitch Mitchell plays on this song, or the way Elvin Jones plays on this song. Like, he would bring up references like that to kind of politely guide me. Mm. And then also just like how to be a professional in a band. You're getting thrown into the deep end a lot with somebody like him, because I mean, there was one day, you know, there's one show where you're playing to like 40 people in the middle of nowhere. And then the next day we were opening for Primus, and like Les Claypool is sitting in with us, and you have to like make sure that Les Claypool is happy with your performance. I mean, it was like really, really high pressure stuff. Or, you know, again, like we're playing in a German village to 15 people. And then the next day you're on like Rock Palast, which is one of like the German national TV shows that's been on for like 50 years. And it's like, Okay, now you got to put this cap on. It was just like, talk about like going through the ringer, you know. It was definitely a huge learning process.
I would even say the audience. I mean, the audience that shows up to see an Adrian Belew show is expecting, you know, a high level of, I'll say, near perfection, right?
Yes. Yes. And I had to learn how to turn the comments off, you know, like I think the first forum review that I read of a show, I wanted to like cry. Because it's just like, dude, this kid sucks, you know, this drummer can't play. But I think, you know, I was also like a baby. So I looking back on it, I'm like, oh, I probably shouldn't have been so hard on myself.
Right. Well, look, I mean, you seem to be making a living, doing well outside of any record company. I mean, you use Bandcamp,
yeah,
small indie labels, social media. You seem to be doing it rather skillfully. And I speak to a lot of artists who started in the traditional model. They built their name that way, and they now have a fan base who follows them. You seem to be building an audience now outside of the traditional music industry, you know, record label business model. I guess this is what it takes to be a professional musician today. Yeah.
I think so. And like, you know, it wasn't like I didn't try. I definitely tried the more traditional routes, but, mm-hmm. you know, my music is not for everyone. So I think I had to have an ego check for a second and be like, well, maybe this Bandcamp way of doing the record, you know, doing a vinyl campaign through Bandcamp, mm-hmm. could be like a new frontier. And it was actually super helpful. I did an interview with Todd Rundgren recently for a podcast, and he was kind of echoing the same thing, where he was like, you know, why not do it yourself? Because then you have like a direct connection with your audience, and you can have complete control over the way that your music is received. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really beautiful. I mean, he's always kind of been that way. He's definitely somebody I think of as like, you know, on the cutting edge of technology and music, and even for his age, he's still like incredibly sharp and like able to talk about the financial and sort of like where art meets commerce aspects of music. Mm-hmm. So that was really helpful to know. And I think, yeah, you know, you do build, you build your audience in a completely different way these days, and what it, by any means necessary. You know, sometimes that means like dancing on TikTok, and sometimes that means like, you know, doing it the old fashioned way.
Like this new album, Wiseacre, it was crowdfunded. And I believe the total crowdfunding request, the goal was less than $5,000. Is that right?
That is true. Yeah.
And how many units did that provide?
So that first run, we sold out of 250 units. And then, you know, after that was done, I was sort of scratching my head and being like, well, does any label want to pick it up now? Because we sold out of records in a month. And then I went on Twitter one day and was just like, hey, does anyone want to reissue the album? And Org Music came to the rescue, and they reissued it. And that's why we're talking.
Wow.
So I think that was pretty cool. Like, they just hit me up and they're like, yeah, you know, we have a lot of mutual friends and we really like the record and we think it would be a good fit for us. And it's great. I mean, the deal is really artist friendly. They're wonderful people, and mm-hmm. I can't say enough good things about them.
Yeah, I'm very grateful for them for bringing this to my attention, because it is a wonderful album. And
thank you.
I would again encourage anyone to go out to ericslick.com, of course, org music, or better yet, go bother your independent record store to order a copy for you there. Buy it from an indie record store if you can. So a lot of your solo projects seem to be 200, 300, 500 records pressed.
Yeah.
Is that like, what role does vinyl play in your music?
Well, I think it's kind of touches on what we were speaking about earlier, where it's like putting a record on is, you know, the way that I really like to listen to music, and, mm-hmm. you know, hearing it from first thought to last thought is, I think, a very important way of understanding a record. So I think it's very important. I mean, at the same time, I do listen to music on the internet, and I listen to, you know, songs here and there, and I listen to playlists too, but I still think at the end of the day, there's nothing like having the tactile thing in your hand and being able to look at the liner notes and being able to see the artwork. Like, I really value that experience. And I thank my parents for that, for sure. The nuggets are done.
Oh, excellent.
So I gotta make. So I hope this makes for a good podcast. But the vegan chicken nuggets are done.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, you heard it here first. The world nuggets. Exclusive.
The nuggets are done, and they're made of soy protein. But yeah, it's still so valuable to me. And even when I go to buy a record, like, you know, I'm going to go to the store, and I'm going to gravitate towards the records that have really beautiful artwork or something. There's some mystique about it, you know, mm-hmm. that's why I like shopping for vinyl. So it plays a huge part. Mm-hmm. And we got a nice little vinyl collection over here in our den. Got a little speaker system, you know, it's cute. Yeah. That's
good. No, it's fun. I love the ritual of it. I mean, that's really the, you know, when it comes time to listen to music, of course you can do the earbuds, and I'm on the train, I'm in the car like everyone else, and you just use whatever tool you have. But at home, having that ritual, having that little altar of the turntable mm-hmm. and the speakers, and being able to just give yourself permission to, you know, stop everything else and just enjoy music is really a treat. You said you have a bit of a vinyl collection. Any particular theme in your collection?
Okay, so my wife is amazing, and she organized all of the vinyl by mood and genre. So, like,
mood.
We have Eric's section, and Eric's section is all of the records that are terrifying to listen to. So there's like Captain Beefheart's Chop Mass Replicas in here, mm-hmm. or like Scott, any of like the later Scott Walker records are in this zone.
Yeah,
and then we kind of have like a world music zone, which is like Brazilian music, like Gal Costa and Serge Gainsbourg, Harumi Hosono, who's a huge influence of mine. Then we have like our friends' bands all organized in one section. And then Dionne Warwick actually gets her own section, because my wife is such a massive Dionne Warwick fan that at one point we made it a goal to get every single one of her albums on vinyl. And we're getting there. We're not all the way there, but we're getting all the classic ones are here. Mm-hmm. So she has her own section. Thank you, Dionne.
Do you guys play each other's records at all, or is it pretty exclusive most of the time?
It just depends. My section, I joke with Natalie, my wife, like, I joke that that's like when she gets out of town, I go wild and like listen to all the super messed up records. I put on all the weird stuff that we can't listen to when we do the dishes.
But would she ever put on Trout Mask Replica?
No, okay. I don't think so, which is okay. I don't mm-hmm. hold that against her, because Trout Mask Replica is a really, really hard record to listen to while you're doing anything. although it's my favorite record of all time. So there
Isn't
you go.
That amazing. Oh my God.
It's so good. I love it so much. I mean, I have two copies of it. I have an original pressing, and I have the Third Man pressing of it.
Oh wow, the multicolor splatter one, I think that
exactly. Oh. And Jack White did such a good job, and the people at Third Man did such a good job. Like, I freaked out when I got it. I couldn't believe how good it looked, and the remastered artwork and everything. So like, fun story, when I was making, I made a string quartet a couple years ago, and I got in contact with Cal Schenkel, who's the guy who did all the artwork for that stuff, like Uncle Meat, that era of Zappa. He did Trout Mask Replica, and I found him, and he painted the cover for my string quartet.
Wow, is that right? Okay,
pretty fun.
That is amazing.
Hey, Nat, here's the nuggets.
Thank you. They look delicious.
Hey, there you go.
Bon appetit.
Yeah, bon appetit, my wife.
That's right. You live in Nashville, so you could just rock on over to Third Man and peruse their racks.
Exactly. But I mean, as soon as the Trout Mask reissue was announced, I think it was online only at first, and I like rushed to sign up for that mailing list, and I made sure I got on that first pressing of it because I was like, It's rare for a Beefheart record to get as much love as another record. Even some of the classic Beefheart records are still like tough to find, or maybe the reissues aren't like the best quality.
Mm-hmm. Now, by going into Captain Beefheart, to me, that tells me that you went through Zappa quite exhaustively and we're still looking for more. Mm-hmm. Do you have a particular Zappa period that you gravitate towards?
Well, these days the 60s stuff is my favorite, but when I was growing up, it was mostly like the late 70s Shake Your Booty era. But like every era of Zappa has something about it that I love. So like even the late 80s stuff, Broadway the Hard Way and the St. Clavier music, like I really love all that stuff. But I think the stuff I gravitate most towards, especially now, is like Uncle Meat, that era. I really, really, really love Uncle Meat. It's such an uncompromising and weird record. Mm-hmm. And it's also so sonically adventurous for the time period. Like, I can't believe that it was recorded in 1968 when I listened to it. It sounds like it's from the future.
That period, I haven't spent as much time with like Uncle Meat and Burnt Weenie Sandwich as I think I need to. Mm-hmm. I started off in the 70s for the Dynamo Hum era, you know, like the entry point of a lot of people, but branching out into You Are What You Is. And then going back even to the 60s era, I think my favorite Zappa album is We're Only In It for the Money.
Oh, that record's amazing. And again, like Uncle Meat and We're Only for the Money are from the same year. So I'm kind of rolling that into my Uncle Meat fandom. Like, We're Only In It for the Money is also still so relevant topically.
Unfortunately,
Unfortunately, but like, I mean, you hear the lyrics on Who Needs the Peace Corps and you're like, these sound like they were written yesterday. I mean, they really do. Aside from, you know, maybe like the Owsley references or like the more time-specific references, but all the other stuff is the same.
Mm-hmm. Do you go for some of his other productions, like Wild Man Fisher or the GTOs?
Not so much. I mean, I am definitely into the Tim Buckley Star Sailor record. Mm. Like that's a pretty big influence on me, but that was like his label, the Bizarre Straight part of Reprise that they let him have, which is unbelievable to even think about. But I don't even know if a major label could take a chance like that today, putting music like that out into the world. But, you know, the Wild Man Fisher stuff, GTOs, I glanced at it maybe once or twice, but it wasn't for me. But yeah, I mean, there's some interesting Zappa productions. He did like I know he did a Grand Funk Railroad album at one point.
Yeah. We just had Rick Nielsen, a Cheap Trick, on the show, and he mentioned that Zappa offered his band, his pre-Cheap Trick band, a spot at the Bizarre label. So it seemed to be that Zappa was hoovering up quite a few bands around that time.
Man, I mean, I love Rick Nielsen. I'm a huge Cheap Trick fan. I think they're one of the, like, I think they're
the greatest. So underappreciated, too.
Oh, my God. I think power pop from the 70s is like long overdue for a renaissance, because the Cheap Trick stuff, Big Star, Nick Lowe, like XTC, Squeeze, like those are all things that were a huge, especially for Wiseacre, were a huge influence. Robert Palmer, you know, that sweet spot of music is like stuff that was influenced by the Beatles, but, you know, had some 70s jankiness to it.
You know what's funny? When we were listening to Wiseacre, my wife and I, we agreed that the best way to describe it, at least in our language, was it's like if Fountains of Wayne was playing songs written by Andy Partridge and being produced by a depressed Jeff Lynne.
That might be the greatest compliment I've ever received. So thank you for that. Those are three of like my, those are like three pillars of my songwriting heroes. So, and Jeff, depressed Jeff Lynne is something I should get tattooed on my body. But Jeff Lynne was, I had this like real watershed moment before I went into record Wiseacre where I heard Turn to Stone on the radio. And I was like, this is it. This is like everything that I like in one song. Like I'd heard that song before and I love that song, but it really dawned on me that like my childhood was soundtracked by Jeff Lynne, especially because like I was born in 87. And I think like Full Moon Fever, Traveling Wilburys, Cloud Nine, all those records are from that time period. And those were the records of my youth. And my parents took me to see Petty on the Full Moon Fever tour. We listened to the Traveling Wilburys record like on vacation every year. So It became a part of my subconscious for sure.
Oh, he's an absolute treasure.
He really is. He's the best.
Anything he touches, I always enjoy. I read you have a record label, Least Records. Have you, are you doing anything with that? I couldn't find anything beyond the fact that it's called Least Records.
Well, I think the name I shot myself in the foot because it was like, you know, if I start a label, I'll advertise that I can sell the least amount of records. And I did. So I only put out one record from actually this amazing band called Hermit Thrushes. Mm-hmm. And I went through the whole process of like packaging it. And we ended up selling out of copies. And it's a great, really, really fun record. But after that, I kind of was like, I don't know if I'm meant for this. And this is a lot of work. And at that time too, I was touring pretty heavily and it was a one man show. So Yeah, I think it's funny that that's still out there, but you've heard it here first. I am not running a label. However, when it came time to put out Wiseacre, we were like, well, we need some label. So we just called it Slick Records. And then I made this funny little melting vinyl logo.
Oh, okay. 'Cause on Discogs, it shows Slick Records and it refers to some label in Sweden.
Oh, I wish. But no, that might be a Discogs error. So if you want to go ahead and fix that, go be my guest.
I will.
But no, Slick Records was just like, Bandcamp asked me if I wanted to come up with a name. And I just was like, why not just use my name? Mm-hmm. And then I made like a little melty vinyl logo. Kind of looks like the Delicious vinyl logo, but melted.
Yeah.
And then that's it. That's the new label. But but no promises.
It should have been a tofu nugget. That's
exactly. Exactly. Should have named the label Tofu Nugget Records.
So it sounds like you've got a lot of material that was created for Wiseacre and no doubt you continued to write. Mm-hmm. Do you have plans for a follow-up sometime in the near future?
Oh yeah. I mean, I'm kind of in the beginning stages of it. So I got about 8 or 9 songs that are great starts. And then, yeah, I'm going to just keep writing and figure out what the next phase is. If I'm going to expound upon Wiseacre, if I'm going to go full self-indulgent and make my Todd Rundgren Utopia prog rock record. I mean, it's anyone's game at this point. So it can go any way. But it's funny. A lot of my friends have been reaching out and they're like, you know, Wiseacre's great, but I really want to hear you just like shred on drums. So maybe there'll be like a drum shred record. Who knows? Okay. I still got to figure it out.
It's funny. Listen to Wiseacre. Knowing you're a drummer, it seemed very restrained. It seemed very Ringo-esque.
Yeah.
Because it would be very steady. But then occasionally you get these glimpses of, oh, holy shit. This is that. Just listening to that drum fill, I know that there's something else there that he's holding back.
Yeah. 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 Well, I think with Wiseacre too, I was trying to kind of like clean the slate and be like, okay, this is where I am as an artist. And like, this is what I want to pursue. So it was kind of like starting over again. And I wonder where my songwriting process is going to take me now that I know what I really liked about making that record and what I think didn't work. So, yeah, maybe I'm going to go full self-indulgent, or maybe it'll just be like a continuation on a theme. So I always think that growing with each record is a good way to go. And I always hated it when I had a favorite band and then I would watch them stagnate in real time. So I'm always trying to push myself to do something different.
Yeah.
What that is, I don't know.
Well, that's part of the mystery, part of the fun. All right. So Eric, thank you so much for coming on the Vinyl Guide. And I got to tell you, I'm very impressed in myself that I haven't called you Earl. We just had Earl Slick on the show, and I've had to willfully make sure, okay, it's Eric.
Do you want to hear a good story? Do you want to end on a good story? So everyone's called me Earl for years. Obviously, there's the Adrian Belew connection too, because they both played with Bowie. Mm. They both play guitar with Bowie. And my dad was at a venue in Philadelphia and he saw Earl Slick. So my dad's like, I'm just going to walk up to him. You know, I wasn't there for this. Mm. He walks up to Earl Slick and he's like, hey, I'm Gary Slick. My son is Eric, plays with Adrian Belew. And Earl like starts cracking up and he's like, you know, everyone calls me Eric Slick and it drives me crazy. So it felt like a nice full circle moment. But speaking of chicken fingers, one last time, I played a show at a chicken finger restaurant, and on the marquee of the restaurant, it said tonight Earl Slick. So who gets the last laugh, you know?
Very good. So look, again, thank you so much for coming on the show. The new album Wiseacre is absolutely wonderful. I'd recommend people go check that out. EricSlick.com. Of course, you could also go to orgmusic.com and get a copy. And the preferred way is always hassle your independent record store for a copy. Have them order it in, grab one, and they'll enjoy it as well. Of course, you can also go to Dr. Dog Music. There's some tour dates that are coming out towards the end of 2021, which is a great sign. There's a lot of record store day activity happening as well. I believe there's another Dr. Dog live album coming out on RSD. The band always celebrates Record Store Day. And again, Eric, thank you so much for coming on the show, mate.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. And I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Enjoy your nuggets, Eric.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Right, there we go. Mr. Eric Slick, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much, Eric, for coming on the show. And everyone, if you want to hear a bit more of this interview, you could always become a patron of the show, patreon.com/vinylguide. Get early access to episodes, secret episodes, extended interviews, and more. And again, don't forget to go into your local record shop, ask them for a copy of Wiseacre. That's a huge help. Thanks again, Eric. And that is it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please, please, please share these episodes on your social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Get them out there. Tell your friends about The Vinyl Guide podcast. Even show them how to use that smartphone of theirs to subscribe to our podcast if they don't know how. That's a huge help. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.